You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming for the Library Foundation. The Library Foundation provides vital support to programs that are essential in keeping Los Angeles Public Library active and engaged in our community. In celebration of Zero Discrimination Day, Aloud is proud to welcome leading scholars on the intersectional issues of gender, race, and disability rights. Today's program is part of a series on power and value that we've presented over the past year. The series focuses on power and its effect on our lives, whether it be in government or whether it be about money, class, discrimination. Power and value come in many forms. While thinking about this event, I was drawn to a quote by Eleanor Roosevelt that I'd like to share with you all. Quote, "Where, after all, do universal human rights begin? In small places, close to home, so close and so small that they cannot be seen on any maps of the world. Such are the places where every man, woman, and child seeks equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity, without discrimination. Unless these rights have meaning there, they have little meaning anywhere." End of quote. We're very fortunate to be presenting in collaboration with the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy at the University of California, Irvine School of Law and UCI Center for Medical Humanities. I'm honored to introduce Professor Michelle Bratcher Goodwin, who was seminal in putting today's program together and will be moderating the conversation. Professor Goodwin is a Chancellor's Professor at the University of California, Irvine, and founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. She is an elected member of the American Law Institute, as well as an elected fellow of the American Bar Foundation and the Hastings Center. Her scholarship appears in nation's leading law reviews, including Harvard Law Review and Yale Law Review. Her editorials and commentaries have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post. She is a regular contributor to Ms. Magazine and the host of the podcast On Issues with Michelle Goodwin. Please welcome Professor Michelle Bratcher Goodwin.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
It's so great to see you. It's wonderful to be with you and for this program. I'm such a fan of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and all that you do. Really, libraries are the revolutionary places in our lives and always have been. So thank you. And so wonderful to be able to lift up this program for Zero Discrimination Day. Let me introduce the guests who are with me today, who are absolutely wonderful. So joining us today are Professor Ruth Kolker and also Professor Jasmine Harris. Professor Kolker is a distinguished university professor and Heck Faust Memorial Chair in Constitutional Law at Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. She's a member of the Board of Directors of the National ACLU, and Professor Kolker is one of the leading scholars in the nation, really around the world, in the areas of constitutional law and disability discrimination. She is the author of 16 books, two of which have won book prizes, and she too is published in the nation's leading law reviews, Yale Law Journal, Harvard Law Review, and in many other esteemed journals. The Supreme Court of the United States has cited her work. I'm also just absolutely thrilled to be joined as well by Jasmine Harris, who is a professor of law and Martin Luther King Jr. Hall Research Scholar at the University of California Davis School of Law. Professor Harris is an expert in disability law, anti-discrimination law, and evidence. She is a law and equality scholar with a particular focus on disability. Her essays have appeared in the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, Tribune, Wire, and so many others. And please, in your virtual land, give them a wonderful round of applause. So we are going to get into it. I get to pretend to be Oprah for you all on this program, and I'm going to ask them to unmic as we begin our program today. So first, could you start us off, and I'll start first with you, Ruth, if you don't mind, to tell us about what got you started in this area of research, doing disability rights and writing so profoundly in this space.
Well, that takes me back quite a few years, almost accidental in a sense. When I moved to New Orleans, Louisiana in 1985, before many members of your audience were probably born, certainly before my students were born, I wanted to do GLBT work. I had moved to Louisiana with my female partner at the time. And as I began to do GLBT work with the Louisiana chapter of the ACLU, immediately the AIDS crisis hit, of course. And that meant all of a sudden learning a little bit about discrimination, disability discrimination law, which is the only vehicle to be used to help people who were perceived to be, you know, a danger to the community because they were HIV positive. So that sort of accidentally got me into doing disability work in the late 1980s. I had done work on race and sex discrimination as a lawyer with the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division. So I had some background in discrimination law, but of course disability is very different. And so over the years, my portfolio sort of grew. And then after I had done a lot of work on what became the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990, I got interested in the field of special education because parents would call me and ask me questions. And unbeknownst to me as well, I had a child who himself qualified for services under the special education laws. And so all of a sudden I became a parent who needed to know something, and I just spread my wings further. You know, for someone who's my age, you would not have gone to law school to study disability issues. That I don't know the courses even offered on the topic. So we're the sort of self-taught generation, but hopefully we've been able to teach the next generation so they'll be more prepared when they start in this field.
I see that also with health law. You know, back in law school, it was basically someone who might be teaching criminal law and doing an aspect of mental health law, but with insanity defense, and that's where it all was. Otherwise, there was no other space for it. Jasmine, so what's your origin story in writing and teaching in this space?
Well, thank you for the question. My origin story is also somewhat accidental, although I have to say that disability has in one way or another always been a part of my life. I have a sister who has a physical disability, and I am a first gen, come from an immigrant household. And so growing up in New York in the Bronx, I had to, at a very young age, get involved in trying to help my parents navigate a system that was incredibly complex. And then there was an added layer of language to it. So it was incredibly challenging. And it just always has been a part of my life. As an academic endeavor, I have to say it was really at my time at Advancement Project when I was doing racial justice work, where I went into communities in North Carolina and was doing community lawyering there. And we were doing racial justice work, but I saw disability work. And I saw the intersection of disability and the school to prison pipeline before it was called that. and really, that was for me the beginning of an intellectual exploration into disability law, what we call disability law, which, as you know, is a lens by which you can view all different areas of law.
Well, speaking of this as a lens, it strikes me that with what both of you have offered is the ability to be able to see. And that leads me to my next question. There would be some that would think, well, it's so isolated in the United States, individuals with disability. Do we really need courses that focus on disability rights and justice? Is this a kind of overblown type of an issue? We have the Americans with Disabilities Act. Hasn't that solved everything? So I want to open this up in terms of a conversation. That's where I want to begin, which is, you know, for those who think that this is really not an issue whatsoever, they don't kind of see it in their lives. Can you help to fill in a little bit more about why it actually does matter to hold front and center conversations such as this? Why is your work important? Why is it important that we have an Americans with Disabilities Act?
Ruth, do you want to go first or shall I?
Go ahead, Jasmine.
So just to set this up, we're talking about the largest minority group in the United States. The CDC last took a census, so to speak, of this group, and there's 61 million adults in the United States. 61 million adults in the United States that have one or more disabilities. This is the only identity care category that you can come in and out of, and most of us, if we live long enough, will get to be a part of. Mm-hmm. It is something that matters to everyone's life. So just in terms of the pervasiveness. The other aspect of it is that we see disability as a separate category. So when you were describing it, it was almost as, you know, here's racial justice or here's disability. And I wanted to bring us together and say, you know, this is exactly why we're having this conversation. And you and your work recognize this, Ruth recognizes this, but disability is not alone. We all have multiple identity categories. And so you can be a person of color and a person with a disability. You can be a person who identifies in terms of sexual identity one way and also be a person of color. So I think this concept of intersectionality is really important. And that's why in many ways on the curriculum point, we haven't to date done our job because disability is not in the curriculum everywhere. So that's my pitch.
Mm-hmm. All right. So Ruth, I'd love to hear you add on to that. So again, you know, both Jasmine identifying, being able to see what was happening on the ground, your work, I know up close because we're colleagues at the ACLU. I know that you recognize these issues. So when you hear folks that say, well, okay, well, let's listen to Jasmine, 61 million Americans, but those Americans are being served in ways that are meaningful. The Americans with Disabilities Act does that. Is it enough? Is there more that we're actually not seeing as part of a cultural conversation with regard to disabilities in the United States?
Well, Jasmine's the real expert on this question. She has a fantastic article coming out called Taking Disability Public. But I'll just talk a little bit about that. You know, when we think about people with disabilities, I think about who those 60 million people are. So many of them are invisible to us. And at this moment with COVID rampant in our population, I think it's especially important to take a moment and pause and think about who we don't know about, who we don't see. This is a library that's sponsoring us, and I just finished reading a book called Decarcerating Disability. And I think that many of us don't realize how many millions of people in the United States live in institutional settings, not of their own choice, but that's the only place where they can receive any kind of care. And so we force them to live in institutional settings.
I think we sometimes lost your volume, Ruth.
I think my internet connection is unstable. Okay, sorry. I'm not sure where I was, but I was mentioning that we have millions of people who live in institutional settings who are disabled, who are not there by choice. They're there because it's the only place in our society in which they can receive health care. And COVID has shown us how being in congregate care is literally deadly. And when we talk about the median age of people dying of COVID as being 80, living in nursing, what we call nursing homes, we're not seeing the many, many hundreds of thousands of people living in congregate care for disability-related reasons. And so it to say it's a human rights issue, where you live, where you can get care, you know, our way of funding healthcare is so terrible in the United States that for many people, the only way they can receive any kind of care, any kind of help is by living in these congregate settings. But the other thing to think about, and this is shows how intersectionality is so important, who's caring for these people living in congregate settings? And I'm sure, Michelle, you know who that is. It's the Black and brown communities, it's low-income people. They, too, are putting their lives at risk to take care of people in congregate settings. And that's, again, because it's the only place we allow these people to live. That's only a tiny snapshot of who are people with disabilities in our society. But it's an important snapshot because it just tells us a little bit about what none of us are seeing. Because in our daily lives, we live in families, we live in homes. We don't see these people who have no choice. I was talking to a friend of mine who does work in this area, and he was describing to me visiting one of the facilities in Northeast Ohio where half the people were living in a basement with no windows, no light. That was their day. And they're not allowed to leave that facility. And they are there supposedly for their own good. It's a mental health facility. Obviously, any of us would have terrible mental illness problems if we had to live in the basement of a building. So it's really important to shed light on this problem. It's another problem of a sort of incarceration, but it's institutionalization that very much impacts low-income people who can't make choices the way other people in our society can.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, because in LA County, it is the largest mental health facility, the LA County Jail, of any place in the country. And I think that puts it right at home, because that shouldn't be, right? The LA County Jail is not a place, incarceration is not a place to address mental health illnesses. And yet there the two are combined, and very likely that conflation is to the harm of many of the people who are being served there, even if LA County is trying to do its best. Doing that behind bars is not ideal. And you mentioned books. So what comes to mind just as you were saying that was Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre and Bertha Mason, Up in the Attic, right? These tropes and these narratives. And I want us to think about history, because we have students amongst the couple hundred people who are joining us right now. We have students and others who actually may not understand the history of how people with disabilities have been persecuted. And not just in novels, not just in Victorian novels, but actually in real life in the United States. So I wanted to surface some of that and turn us first to eugenics and Buck v. Bell, and hoping that perhaps, Jasmine, you might tell us a little bit about that case and how disabilities intersect. It's a case that goes before the United States Supreme Court in 1927.
Absolutely. So in Buck versus Bell, what's particularly striking, and I'll just give a quick overview, is it's a case about institutionalization, it's a case about poverty, it's a case about disability first and foremost, and disfavored bodies. And in that decision, it's Oliver Wendell Holmes, who's one of our most respected jurists, sort of, you know, in our academy, right? And he writes this decision that is one of the shortest decisions of the Supreme Court, and in fact, almost a complete majority. Only one justice dissented. And as a matter of history, we now know why. We know that that particular justice was rooted in his Roman Catholic faith. And so as a matter of principle, he dissented, but did not issue an opinion. Oliver Wendell Holmes had to look at the Virginia Sterilization Act, and it was a test case. At that point in time in 1927, eugenics as a principle, as an ideology, started to decline. And the proponents of eugenics ideology came together and said, well, if this was legal in states, perhaps we will get this rush and this renewed energy. And so there was a young woman, Carrie Buck, whose mother was institutionalized and was described as someone with an intellectual and developmental disability. And Carrie was working, she was a poor woman, poor white woman, who was working for a family. And now history has shown and proven to be true that she was actually a victim of rape and a survivor of rape in that household by a family member. And the family wanted to cover it up. It was a well-to-do family. And so they moved to have her institutionalized and to have her sterilized. And Carrie Buck's case was essentially the test case for the Virginia Sterilization Act. And so Oliver Wendell Holmes had to decide, is this legal? Is compulsory sterilization legal? And what he rooted his decision in as a matter of law was really that sterilization was just like vaccinations.
So back to the pandemic, but in the worst awful ways.
The worst possible way. We're back to the pandemic, but that was the way he saw it. And of course, we all know his most famous line is, three generations of imbeciles are enough. Speaking of not only Carrie Buck's mother, but also the child, which was presumed to have that hereditary link of intellectual or mental disability.
And Jasmine, in adding to that, thank you so much for that. That was wonderful. That piece, people should just like tape so that they have and can play over and really understand that case. And, Carrie was part of a cohort of people considered to be unfit, this kind of linguistic of unfitness, which then could empower a state to take away the reproductive capacities of individuals who are considered unfit. And in fact, to your point, Justice Holmes says that the laws that are broad enough to cover vaccines and compulsory vaccination are broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. Right. I mean, you just can't make it up in terms of just how brazen and explicit the case is. And what many people may not realize is that the coming attractions before movies after that case are about eugenics in the United States. We've sterilized 2,000, we've sterilized 5,000, right. All with this, we're getting rid of these folks that are considered unfit and providing the model that's picked up by the Nazis in Germany. They pick up literally this Virginia law for adaptation for their laws. But I want to broaden the conversation because it also has, implications for race as well. It's a tool that ends up being used against Indigenous women, women in Puerto Rico, Black girls and women. It becomes known as the Mississippi appendectomy, right? This tool of forced sterilization. But we know that that's not the only vestige of the horrors and the pains associated with discriminating against individuals who are perceived to have disabilities. I also want to talk briefly about Willowbrook. So I'm wondering, Ruth, if I know this wasn't on our agenda at all, but I wonder if you might be able to surface in a little bit about that too, how our country has perhaps failed to be accountable in taking care of those who have been placed in care.
Well, I'm not as quite as prepared as Jasmine to sort of do a 10 minute on Willowbrook, but let me take your question and actually segue us to a related topic just to sort of show how broad these tentacles are. So Willowbrook, of course, is about forced institutionalized care with inhumane conditions, a part of a movement in the United States that really began in the 1950s to deinstitutionalize the care and treatment of people so that they wouldn't have to be in these you've probably seen some photographs of some of these places. It just, people are basically in chains, they're naked, it's unthinkable. But let me just, it's a little bit of a segue, but let me make it a little bit of a segue, if you don't mind, Michelle, which is that in 1975, so now we're getting to more contemporary history, right? That some of your listeners may still be alive in this moment. In 1975, Marion Wright Edelman, whose name may be familiar to many people, she founded the Children's Defense Fund, African-American woman. She noticed by going through some census data that a lot of children weren't in school. And she thought, oh, this must be the vestiges of race discrimination, that maybe we just don't have schools open to Black children, right? That was a reasonable hypothesis in 1975. And she went and did research and found that, yes, many of those children were African-American, absolutely. But the reason they were being excluded from school was because of their disabilities. And as recently as 1975, if you were born with an intellectual or developmental disability, the public school was not open to you. And I have a great, great uncle who was born with intellectual disabilities who never spent a day in school. I mean, it would have been unthinkable. Obviously he was born in the early 20th century, but it would have been unthinkable for him to have, attended school. And so again, from this intersectionality perspective, what does it say about what we think about people? We don't even think, the states had laws said if you're not educable, then you don't go to school. What does it mean to be educable? And they just look at you when you're 4 or 5, right? And you're a Black boy in the South, you're not educable, right? And so to the extent that these children were allowed into the school systems, they were entirely segregated. There'd be whole facilities just for them. And the education they were receiving wasn't meaningful. And so in 75, we passed our first special education laws, and we have far that we need to still go. But it's, so it's not just, I mean, as awful as it is for there to be a Willowbrook and for there to be these state institutions where people are housed and live 24/7, it's also horrific to think that our public schools don't welcome all children to the classrooms. And we still have parents fighting for their kids to be in a regular integrated classroom in a public school building, receiving an education that might allow them to just receive a basic bare bone education. Well, and that's still happening in 2021.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because I think that these historical foundations are really important, right? Just getting a sense of the depravity is really important, because it's so easy to just paper over what was instantiated by law, including in the United States Supreme Court. You know, what was normal? I mean, with Willowbrook, you know, it was Geraldo Rivera who did this expose and brought the cameras in. And it was horrific to see state-sponsored institutions or institutions receiving state funds and the conditions in which children and adults were living in their own waste and feces, things that, you know, are chilling for our viewers and listeners to hear, but that are real, right? That are important that we not paper over, because there's so much US exceptionalism, this sort of notion that we're big, we're great, and yet, you know, there are communities of people who've been harmed. But to your point, Ruth, let's segue and talk about what these issues mean in contemporary terms. And let's start with education, because I also want to get to voting. And I also want to think about these issues with relation to women and sexual assault. So let's think about education and the ways in which this is also intersected with the school to prison pipeline, right? So let's talk about what does segregation, right? Because we have active living segregation in American schools that relate to disabilities and that also relate to race. So I put it out there for either of you to talk about how this also relates to, you know, the mass incarceration pipeline, school to prison pipeline. Are there ways in which you see that?
Jasmine, you want to talk about school discipline a little bit?
Sure, I'm happy to. So with respect to school discipline, we have a situation where for many years, as a product of the sort of zero tolerance in the war on drugs, this no tolerance discipline policy started to basically sweep the nation. And so public schools would adopt these principles that would say, okay, so if you launch a spitball, then you could be excluded from school 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. What was happening was essentially that many of these young people were in poorly resourced schools and communities of color, and they were being excluded day after day. So they would come to the doors, they would lock the doors, or they would have a small infraction and they would lose 7 days, 8 days, whatever it was. Imagine the amount of work that individual would have to make up, right? Seven periods in a day. So they fall behind. Okay, so there's one narrative where it is young people who don't have disabilities who are being pushed out of the system pushed out of schools and into the prison pipeline because they are being left behind. They are being excluded from school rather than school being more welcoming and giving and pulling them in. The solution is let's exclude them from school, right? And the whole idea of school safety, they brought in resource officers. And so as a result, by bringing police on campuses, having a zero tolerance policy, it's the same idea as broken windows, except it's in schools. It's, look, small infractions, big punishment. It's going to divert people from and discourage them from actually
acting out. That's right. And you know, it seems to me there are also some conflations too, because, you know, the data can also track to children who are in EBD programs, depending upon where you live in the nation. EBD, emotional behavior disabilities, is kind of catch-all category,
right.
That are deeply racialized, sort of stratified by class, right? Because we know that amongst these classes, they're more likely to be Black and Brown, and they're more likely to be children who happen to come from poor and working class families, and these are the kids that are more likely to experience these kinds of infractions, right? The punishments, right, for the infractions that lead to a school to prison, you know, pipeline. Ruth, has, you know, your work and research taken up any of these kinds of questions?
Yeah, the disability, the special education disability issue is one of the most complex ones I've ever looked at. And so let me just give you a little taste of what makes it so difficult and complex. The way the special education laws work is you have to be classified as a child with a disability who would benefit from special education related services to get any help at all. And so there's this question of who counts as disabled for the purposes of special education law. And if you do count as disabled for the purpose of special education law, you actually have some important procedural and substantive protections. And Jasmine and I both have fought for a lot of kids, you know, to get them those protections. They're really important. But it's an on-off switch. You're either in or you're not. And so one can imagine that, you know, middle-class parents who have more resources can more easily find the professionals to help their child get the help they need. But the other thing is that every child has to have a label, a classification. What we find is those labels are very racially charged. And you were suggesting this a minute ago, Michelle. So if we look at something like emotional behavioral disturbance, we see a lot of African-American boys in that category. White children are called autistic. That's more acceptable. And labels like intellectual disability, again, very strong racial propensity for Black boys and Black girls, but Black boys in particular, to be classified there. And so we see this good faith attempt by Congress, right, to get resources to people who need help, that then becomes a mechanism to classify people in a way that is makes it more likely that the education they receive is segregated. And so by segregated, I mean that they go to these things called resource rooms all day instead of being in the regular public school classroom. Or they might go to a whole school just for kids with emotional behavioral disabilities. I'm sure you can imagine what those schools are like. And so it's so ironic that Marion Wright Edelman's vision, right, was to promote integration. I mean, there's no one who cares more about that than Marion Wright Edelman. But then the statute that she helped craft becomes a vehicle for segregation. Now, does it have to be that way? Of course not. And I think a lot of schools are starting to see some of those problems. And in California, I think some schools have actually taken some good progressive steps to sort of undo some of those problems. But it's such a complicated system. So I've had some Black parents say to me, special education is death. The last thing I want is my child to be classified as disabled, because if my child is classified as disabled, he's going to be segregated. He's not going to be taught. And I'm like, no, the special education law is there to get you some help that your child needs. But I hear their pain. I can't tell them they're wrong.
Right, Ruth? I mean, that's the truth. I mean, I worked in this area in Kentucky. I saw it, and you're absolutely right. What middle-class and upper-income white parents can bring through the lens of autism for their children and still sometimes not get the services that their kids need. But when we talk about dumping grounds, and then that's when we're talking about Black and brown kids. I mean, I'll tell you, there's a school that I worked with when I first stepped into that school, Ruth, so long ago. I had gotten a call from a parent, and her child had been taken away, arrested at the school, charged with a crime of moral turpitude. I'm coming in and find out like what happened. And the child had just simply used an explicative with his teacher. And that was it. There was nothing physical. He called her the B word. He's arrested. He's in jail. And then I see the school. So I'm like, okay, I've got to deal with that and meet with the teacher. But the school, bars on the window, over 96% free and reduced lunch, 86% Black and Latino. And these kids had no library. They had no gymnasium. Where the kids ate looked like a hammer had been taken and broken through a wall and some tables had been put there. All of the books were the second hand from the other schools. And that's the reality that the parents are talking about, that they don't want that. And sadly, that still exists in parts of our country. So you're absolutely right. The resources are there. And then it's a question about, are the school districts doing what they're supposed to be doing in terms of funneling the resources where they're supposed to be? All right, next question. There's so much there. But I also want to talk about voting. We've just come through an election almost like no other that lingered on. We saw an insurrection at the beginning of the year. And in the wake of all of that, it'd be easy perhaps to not pay attention to the struggle that individuals with disabilities had to be able to vote during COVID and during a time in which people just aren't paying attention. So since a lot of people don't necessarily think about these issues, can you tell us a little bit about how voting rights and disability justice emerge?
I could.
I
always volunteer every election day to help people with disabilities vote. So it's something dear to my heart. The Help America Vote Act that was passed after that odd 2000 election guarantees that people with visual impairments are now able to vote independently and confidentially by having access to a machine, you know, that would speak to them so that they can actually vote. Although that's not universally adopted, it really is monumental. Let's say something good that has happened. Because it used to be that if you were visually impaired, you would have to tell someone else how you wanted to vote and hope that they recorded your intentions. You know, that's not what the rest of us do. So that's important. But the Help America Vote Act also says that people should be able to engage in curbside voting if they can't go into the voting booth itself. During COVID, the need for curbside voting, of course, expanded dramatically since so many people have illnesses that made COVID more dangerous to them. Unfortunately, a lot of states just weren't set up to be able to handle curbside voting on election day for the volumes of people that would like to choose that option. The other thing that we're seeing now, as I'm sure everyone knows who follows those elections, is that many, many people in the last election voted by mail, didn't have to go to the voting booth at all. That's great for a lot of people with disabilities for whom travel is so important. I mean, for many people, they don't own a car. They can't necessarily drive. Public transportation is not always especially available and where many people live, and getting to the voting place can be difficult. So as we know, a lot of states created no excuse absentee balloting, which tremendously helped many people with disabilities vote. Now some states are talking about, cutting that back because too many people voted, right? They don't like that result. The other thing that I volunteer and help with on election day is that people who are in institutional settings are entitled to be able to vote. And sometimes people find themselves unexpectedly in the hospital on voting day. They had planned to vote, but they can't. And so we had a hotline here with our disability rights organization to help those people who we could locate who found themselves unexpectedly hospitalized. And every state has to have a system in place to allow those people to vote, even though they can't ask for an absentee ballot at the last minute. Normally they have to have exceptions for people, a reasonable accommodation, we call it. They have to have exceptions for people to be able to. So if any of your listeners find themselves unable to vote on election day for something unexpected that has occurred, that requires them to be hospitalized, they should call their local disability rights organization. Hopefully they'll have a hotline and people like me who can get them the forms they need so that they can vote.
Michelle, may I jump in just for a moment, please?
Absolutely. And then we're going to turn to some of our listener viewer questions. Absolutely, sure. Jasmine. Go right on in.
So I just wanted to offer two additions to Ruth's great comments on voting. And the first is, I want to remind everyone about the People First versus Alabama case that was just at the Supreme Court, that was just about curbside voting, and it was labeled a disability case. And so what I want to do is just for a moment put out there that perhaps when you look at the communities that would be voting in that particular county, they just so happen to be communities of color. And so what is the benefit of framing this as a disability issue as opposed to a race issue? Well, it has to do with constitutional law, and it has to do with the constitutional levels of scrutiny. And so what we may see moving forward is some of these, and this is because of intersectionality, that some of the restrictions that states will place on voting, on fundamental rights, will be framed in disability terms because it has a lower level of constitutional scrutiny than race does. And so I think that we need to pay attention to that. So that's one issue. The second issue, and I will do this very quickly because I can't wait to hear the listeners' questions. The second is this issue of conservatorship or guardianship. And so one thing that we really need to pay attention to is that many states, well, let me take a step back. Not all states have set it up so that their voters who are under conservatorship or guardianship know that they can, in their state where it's permissible, they can still vote, even if they're under guardianship. Now, there's a broader movement happening across the country to move away from these plenary guardianships that take away rights across the board and disaggregate those rights, just providing support for the ones that are needed. So I want to put those two issues out there so that it kind of supplements what we've been talking about.
Well, and that will build on questions. So there's so many questions in the Q&A, which is just fabulous, but let's get to a couple of them. All right, so are hospitals and nursing homes set up to facilitate voting by their patients? If not, how can we make that a standard practice? Ruth.
Well, there's huge room for improvement. In my limited experience, often there's a social worker or a nurse at the hospital who knows the phone number to the local disability rights organization and can help someone get the forms they need. It's obviously it's going to be state by state, even county by county, but it takes having an insider in the hospital, and maybe there's some hospital administrators, on this webinar today, but it usually takes someone with institutional knowledge, because if you're unexpectedly hospitalized, you're not going to come in as an expert knowing how to vote, right? You need someone at the hospital to help you. And the only reason I know how to do it is I have this cheat sheet that our disability rights organization sends me every year that I use to sort of make sure I give someone the right information. I should tell you, it is really complicated. Like, it depends upon how many days ago they were hospitalized. And I mean, it's not simple whether they're hospitalized in the county in which they vote or they're not. I mean, it's complicated. But if there are insiders in the hospital, they can help make it happen.
Well, it also makes me think about the ways in which we can distribute things like those cheat sheets to hospitals, to nursing homes, and also to civil society organizations that care about justice related issues. So, all right. So for those crafty students who are on this call and listening, there is work for you to do. Write some, your 2L and 3L year, write some law review articles about how we get greater accessibility. All right, another question. Could you talk about employment opportunities for people with disabilities after they come out of school when they're 21 years old? What laws promote opportunities for employment for individuals with disabilities? Do we have laws that promote, right? Like, we kind of have a negative constitution. You can't do things to people, but we don't necessarily have a government that says, here's what we will do for you. But are there areas that you know about, Jasmine and Ruth, where government does in fact lift up individuals with disabilities?
Well, I do want to say that this is one of those areas where we need to do more. Because transition services from the special education system to either vocational training or higher education, it's horrendous. Now, the IDEA, that is to say the special education law, says that it should start, that transition should begin as early as age 14. Well, in reality, what that's supposed to look like is someone from the local vocational services agency will come in and talk about goals. It just doesn't happen. So I agree with you, Michelle, that big picture, it is a negative system, but what we do have is there are programs that do support job training and placement, but that is not something that is institutionalized. And I say that in the sense that it's routine. And we don't have the resources for that. I will say that there is a move away from supported employment for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and not sheltered workshops. And so we've moved away from sub-minimum wage.
So I want to ask another question that's been put in our Q&A. How can HR professionals proactively make workplaces more inclusive for people with disabilities? So Ruth, in your work and research, what have you surfaced? And your work has been cited by the Supreme Court. So you know what you're talking about, Ruth.
Well, I don't know. It's a very arcane constitutional law principle that I could put everyone to sleep about. But well, first of all, and Jasmine and I are doing some writing about this from a teaching perspective. First of all, as an HR person, you should assume that everyone is a person with a disability. And you should really think about what we call universal design principles so that you make sure that workplace is physically accessible, right? If you have elevators, they actually work. If you have restrooms, I'm sure you have restrooms, you make sure your restrooms are genuinely accessible, not just have a label on the front door, but they actually meet the standards for accessibility. So you really think about the physical structure of your workplace and don't wait until you have someone who is disabled working there. You put it in as part of the basic design. And then when you do things like hold meetings, you know, you expect that people in that meeting will include people with ADHD, with learning disabilities, and you structure that meeting with expectations for how much concentration you expect people to have within an hour, whatever the length of the meeting is. And so you need to proactively assume everybody is a person with a disability until they tell you otherwise. And then, of course, when people do identify themselves as having a disability, you really work with them and have what we call an interactive communication, once you talk about what you can do to support them to be successful. There are a lot of studies out there that say that the average cost of an accommodation that someone needs at the workplace is somewhere between $150 and $300. It's not much. No. It can be a microphone. It can be a piece of software. It can be a standing desk. It can be something relatively modest in price that has a huge payoff in terms of worker productivity. And what we have found is that workers who are disabled often are the most loyal because they appreciate that they're in a workplace that's supportive. And so, and we shouldn't be doing things because of rewards on investment. I mean, we should be doing these things because it's the morally right thing to do. But I think that HR professionals will also find that they will just make the workplace a better place by being more accommodating to people with disabilities.
So here's a question that rings home across the country. And we do have a national audience joining us today. How do educators distinguish between true disabilities and racial inequalities, lack of foundational education? That's a significant issue. So how do we give a response to that? One that's succinct, because I also want to get to maybe a couple of additional questions.
Okay, succinct. First thing I would say is, I think we're in a society where we are motivated by this desire to smoke out fraud with respect to disability. And so I think I understand the question. And so I want to answer that question, but I want to put that out there that's part of the problem is that we see things as legitimate and illegitimate disabilities. What I take the question to mean is, how do we figure out whether someone has a need that we need to serve? And I would say it doesn't matter whether it's a legitimate disability as it's framed or whether it's because of structural racism, because guess what? At the end of the day, if we tackle the structural inequalities in society over time, we may see a decrease in, let's say, the request for accommodations.
I wonder if the question, that's one interpretation. The way that I interpret it were some of the cases that I got called on where an uncle or an aunt or a mom might say, my child is being recommended to be to receive disability services, removed from the classroom and placed into special ed. And I have a smart child. I have a child they just don't want in the classroom. And we know that. And this is horrible, right? That disability services end up being a dumping ground in a certain kind of way for Black and brown kids. And so much of that I saw, and I remember going into meetings where the response of the teachers why this child needed to be removed from the classroom is because the child was reading and explaining things to the classmates, because the child wanted to hug the teacher. And the parent saying, well, when you remove my child, I know that's your pipeline out the door. And that's what you're, so that's the way that I interpret it, that, but it could be either.
So just if I have 1 minute, just a minute, yes, answering that version, I would say that this is an area where we need a civil Gideon, a type of mandatory representation, because it's so much red tape that I don't think that parents who are lawyers and maybe even work in this area can navigate it on their own. And so I will actually say something about California. California recently changed and moved from a system where you could have advocates, lay advocates without law degrees, and they could go in and assist. But now they've made it so the administrative hearings have to be, you have to be represented by a lawyer who's licensed in California. This is a real access to justice issue. So for the question, you do need some support, go to your local protection advocacy organization or to your local CELPA.
Yeah, no, that's that. Thank you for that, because I think that that's a struggle that many parents have and feel overwhelmed when they're in ARC meetings and trying to get the, you know, IEPs together, the individual evaluation plans for their kids. All right. There's so much more. I wish I had 2 more hours with you all. This is unfair. We need to do this for longer. All right. But 2 quick things. One, how does sexual violence figure into conversations about disability justice and disability rights? Either of you want to take that on? Is it
an issue? That's more your topic, I think.
Well, it is, right? But Jasmine, do you have anything that you might want to add? Is that an issue here?
Very, very, very quickly, I think that there are 2 things to think about. The first is to think about the tension that historically people with disabilities have been desexualized. And so they lack that, this perceived that they lack this sexual autonomy. And so that weighs against a really stark number, which is that the incidence of sexual assault and abuse against people with intellectual disabilities is 7 times the rate of someone who's non-disabled, 7 times. And so we have this tension between autonomy and the actual need to do something about this. And so my solution, to end on the solution here, is I think we need greater sunlight, we need greater visibility, and we don't have that right now because disability is seen as something that's very private.
Yeah, it reminds me of a documentary that was premiered on HBO some years ago, it was maybe a decade ago, and it was about the boys in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, these individuals who were sexually abused at the home in which they were cared for. It was a Catholic Church facility, and it's a heartbreaking documentary because they were vulnerable and literally unable to speak out in terms of words orally what they were experiencing. And it's a very touching, moving tale as they attempted to, you know, find justice. But you're absolutely right. People who are silenced in whatever capacities they are happen to be the most vulnerable to power. All right, so the final question, and again, I could do this for so long with the two of you, homelessness. So are these issues that have surfaced in your work in terms of disability justice and individuals who experience homelessness? Is there an intersection there?
That's a really hard question. So there's a little bit of a myth that people are released from institutional settings and are then just put on the streets. And that these people that you may see sleeping outdoors have been recently released from institutional settings. There's actually no data to support that. What the data does support is that we live in a society in which we don't provide adequate healthcare, and that we live in a society that doesn't provide adequate housing or food or basic necessities. And so there are many people who decide, right, as a rational choice, that it makes more sense for them to sleep on the streets than to go to these homeless shelters that we have, which are not a whole, for a lot of people, are not a big step up from sleeping on the streets. And so Sure. It's obviously anyone who sleeps on the streets is not going to be someone who has a lot of financial resources. And we know that disproportionately Black and Brown people are likely to have few financial resources. It's also true with people with disabilities are the poorest group in the society. So, you know, intersectionality, you know, that's going to make a huge difference. And so we just don't, it just, this is a situation that is public. We do see them, but then people make assumptions about who these people are without actually knowing who they are. And I know that in a lot of communities now, there's been talk about call 311 instead of 911, you know, to get people services. But that worries me because many of these people don't want to be pushed into institutionalized care. That is not, that's not what they want. And we, that's our only alternatives right now, right? If you don't sleep on the street, well, we're going to put you in jail or we're going to put you in an institutionalized setting of some sort. And we just don't have a full set of options for such people. So it's a dire issue that we could spend a whole hour on, I'm sure.
We could. And I wonder, you know, what we do about that. So here's something that I would like to ask as a final question. I've been told that I get just a few more minutes because folks are staying on and they're not dropping off. Okay. So that is what going forward is a silver lining for us. I mean, the issues that we've highlighted are very serious. Voter disenfranchisement. We've seen how COVID has affected individuals with disabilities in ways that have just simply not been accounted for. There's much to sort out in terms of education and thinking about a healthcare system that, as you mentioned, Ruth, is broken. It's broken for everybody. And the weight of that is felt in unique ways on individuals with disabilities. So with all of that, it's possible to come away thinking that, gosh, it's a system that just is broken and there is no hope. But do you see something that's hopeful in the line of the work that you do or that others are doing or work that you want to promote before we wrap up? I'll start with you, Jasmine.
I do, Michelle. I do see something hopeful. And what I see is that we have good bones, right? There's a good structure that we have in terms of the Americans with Disabilities Act and related laws. What we need is enforcement. We need to have the Department of Justice, the EEOC, and the various agencies that are responsible for enforcing these laws, they have to just step up their enforcement actions. And we've seen during the Obama administration brought Olmstead enforcement actions to really just aggressively do that. And so we need to see that level of commitment to disability rights, which I'm hopeful about because this was the first election in perhaps forever, maybe slightly the last one, where the candidates talked about disability, where and I want to say, just let me give a shout out to the disability rights activists who did that. It wasn't suddenly that, you know, I'm sure President Biden is very woke, but I'm sure they woke up and he said, literally, I'm going to reach out to the disability community. No, they're activists who are out there every day doing this work. And so I am hopeful because of the work that they do and the results that I know we are already seeing.
Thank you so much for that, Jasmine. Ruth,
So we've talked about the problems with the special education laws, but let's talk about the strengths of the special education laws. We have record number of students who got the services they needed in K-12 to be prepared to go to community college or a four-year university and continue their education. And we now have four-year universities and community colleges learning that they have a population of students with disabilities who they need to accommodate so they can be successful. And I have, I'm sure Jasmine's in the same way, I have so many students in my classes now who identify as disabled, who are comfortable talking about that, and they're in law school. And, you know, they're committed to a practice someday to help others, you know, to lift other people up as well. And so a lot has changed in terms of high school graduation rates, now college and community college graduation. And so, you know, that's a promising future. Now it means that employers are going to find themselves working with more people who openly identify as disabled and are just going to ask for their rights. And those HR people who asked you the question earlier, you know, are going to have to step up. But there's so much good going on in terms of accessibility with websites being more accessible to people with visual impairments. I mean, the technology has created so much opportunity for many, many people with disabilities that they could not have had before. There's a lot of reason for hope. And it just takes all of us pushing to make sure that things continue to move in the right direction. If I can just end with one tiny little story, I had a student I helped a number of years ago who at her four-year university was failing all of her classes because she was visually impaired and couldn't see her books and everything else. And we litigated, we got a great settlement. She's now at a new university. She's going to graduate fairly soon. She's going to graduate Phi Beta Kappa.
Wow.
And that, all she did was get the rights that the ADA entitled her to, but she wasn't stupid. She was just blind, and it's not a big deal for her. She's used to being blind. It was a big deal for the university because they didn't know how to deal with her, but you know, she found a university that was willing to be accommodating, and she's an outstanding student. She's near the top of her class. So there's a lot of great people out there who are going to be doing great work. And a lot of them are going to be people with disabilities who are going to help advance this cause further, which is really exciting to see.
Well, speaking of which, and then thinking about the connection to the ACLU that you have, that I have, Helen Keller was one of the founders of that organization. So our guests, our listeners, our viewers, those who've connected with us today, I want to thank you all, and I hope that you will join me in thanking Professor Ruth Kolker, Professor Jasmine Harris, for lending their expertise and their insights to this program today, and to our friends at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles for providing the platform for us to bring this conversation to you today. We are absolutely grateful that you joined us for ongoing challenges of disability discrimination in law, politics, and society. We hope to continue to do this kind of important programming and to think about the issues that were elevated today, which are deeply intersectional as they relate to race and class and sex and LGBTQ equality. When I think about Professor Kolker saying that part of what got her to this space was thinking about the AIDS crisis that was taking place in the United States. Clearly, this is not a conversation that is over. As I've said, I could spend hours more with these friends and colleagues who were part of this important conversation. I hope you'll take with what you learned today and share it with others. I hope that you will want more programming like this to be lifted up. And I just want to conclude with, again, thanking Ruth and thanking Jasmine for just being such informative and insightful panelists this afternoon and evening, depending upon where you are. Thank you so much for joining us, and until soon, good night.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.